I want you to take a second and just picture the absolute worst boss you have ever had.
Oh, man. Yeah, we've all got at least one that immediately comes to mind.
Right, seriously, like conjure them up in your mind right now. The micromanager, the credit stealer, or the one who sent those incredibly passive aggressive emails at like 11 p.m. on a Saturday.
And you just have to sit there and read it, knowing your weekend is ruined.
Exactly. We all have one. And when we think about these people, we usually arrive at the same, I don't know, comforting conclusion. We just think, well, they are just bad people.
Yeah, like they were just born that way.
Right. Like they just have a terrible personality and they somehow manage to, trick the hiring committee into giving them a corner office. But what if that assumption is entirely wrong?
This is where it gets fascinating.
Because what if they weren't always like that? What if the actual day-to-day experience of holding power psychologically rewired their brain?
It really completely flips the script on how we view the workplace. Because when you reframe bad leadership, not just as someone having a grating personality, but as an observable, measurable organizational disease, it completely validates the frustration you might be feeling at work right now.
Which is incredibly validating, honestly.
It is. You aren't just dealing with a difficult person. You are likely dealing with a structural pathology.
Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we are exploring the very real pipeline that turns a perfectly normal, competent manager into a toxic leader.
And it's a very clear pipeline when you look at the data.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to look at how that toxicity directly fries a team's nervous system and what this all means for anyone navigating a workplace hierarchy today. And our source for this exploration is this fascinating 2026 research paper.
It's a really great study.
It really is. It's titled Hubris in Educational Leadership: Toxic Leadership as a Mechanism Linking Power and Teacher Burnout. It was written by researcher Aysan Sharer, published in the International Society That Learned journal.
And I think it's important to note, while this specific study focuses on school principals and teachers, the underlying psychological mechanisms, about how authority distorts human cognition, they apply to virtually any hierarchical organization.
Oh, totally. Like corporate, medical, whatever.
Exactly. Whether you are in a corporate office, a hospital, a tech startup, or even a retail environment, the mechanics of unchecked power are just remarkably consistent.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because the paper makes a huge narrative pivot right out of the gate regarding how we view awful bosses.
Right, the whole bad apple theory.
Yeah, we usually think of bad leaders as bad seeds. A company accidentally hires a narcissist, so boom, they get narcissistic leadership. But this paper argues that maybe the seed was totally fine when it was planted. It's the fertilizer of power that actually mutated it.
What's fascinating here is that this is the core premise of the whole paper, and it introduces this concept called hubris syndrome.
Hubris, which, I mean, we throw that word around a lot in casual conversation.
We do. We use it as a synonym for just simple arrogance, like, oh, that guy is so full of hubris. But in the context of this research, it is a very specific acquired condition.
Acquired, so not something you're born with.
Exactly. Unlike narcissism, which psychology generally understands as a relatively stable personality trait, a person carries it with them throughout their entire life. Hubris syndrome is context dependent.
Okay.
It is a fundamental personality change that is directly associated with the exercise of substantial power over time.
Wait, so it's not something you bring into the office on day one. It's literally something the office does to you over the course of years.
Precisely. The researcher points out that hubris intensifies with success, with authority, and this is the biggest part, with the absence of corrective feedback.
Ah, so when no one is telling you no.
Right. When a leader is insulated from criticism, their cognition actually begins to distort. The paper conceptualizes this syndrome through a few distinct dimensions.
What do those look like in practice?
Well, there's an excessive, almost grandiose self-confidence, a growing contempt for the opinions of others, a relentless focus on maintaining power, and ultimately, a dangerous detachment from reality.
Detachment from reality. I mean, that is a genuinely terrifying phrase to associate with the person who approves your vacation time and writes your performance review.
It is terrifying because when a leader becomes detached from reality, they no longer base their decisions on the practical, ground-level feedback of their team.
Because why would they? They think they know better.
Exactly. They operate from an inflated sense of their own infallibility. They start to feel that the standard rules just no longer apply to them. And worse, The lived experiences of their subordinates simply stop registering as valid data points.
Wow.
Yeah, they lose their empathy because cognitively they no longer see themselves as being on the same plane of existence as the people they manage.
Okay, so if this is a disease of unquestioned authority, my mind immediately goes to like a tech CEO with no board oversight, or maybe a Wall Street banker.
Sure, the classic movie villains.
Right. But this researcher didn't look there. They studied public school principals. And when I think of schools, I think of, you know, collaboration, nurturing, community. Why is this paper singling out educational leadership as a prime breeding ground for this specific kind of power trip?
It seemed so counterintuitive at first, right? But it has everything to do with the unique organizational asymmetry of a school.
Okay, what does that mean exactly?
Well, think about the structure of a typical public educational environment. The principal holds highly centralized, prolonged authority. They have an immense amount of symbolic legitimacy in their community. But on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis, they operate with very limited external oversight.
Oh, I see. Because the district superintendent isn't hovering in the hallway every morning.
Exactly. The principal is essentially the undisputed ruler of their own fiefdom.
Right. And within that fiefdom, they have massive unilateral influence over their subordinates' daily conditions.
They really do. They control teaching assignments. They dictate resource allocation. They conduct the performance evaluations that entirely determine a teacher's career trajectory.
That is a lot of unchecked power for one building.
It is. When you combine that level of absolute control with a lack of immediate corrective feedback from higher-ups, you basically have the perfect petri dish for hubris to fester. The prolonged exposure to unquestioned authority normalizes the power dynamic in their own mind.
Let's ground this in a real-world scenario. Say a principal decides, just out of the blue, that the school is going to implement a highly controversial new grading system.
A classic administrative move.
Right. And the teachers who actually do the grading, they say, hey, this doesn't work for our students. It's going to cause chaos. Now, a normal leader takes that feedback, but a hubristic principal ignores it entirely, right?
Absolutely. Because they start to believe their own hype.
Yeah. They start to think, I am the school. And any pushback from a teacher is seen not as helpful feedback, but as, like, literal insubordination.
That is the exact mechanism. You've hit on the transition from internal thought to external action. And because schools are institutions built heavily on moral authority and professional asymmetry, a leader who develops hubris in this environment causes profound systemic damage.
Right. It's not like a corporation where you just lose some money.
Exactly. They aren't just messing with quarterly profit margins. They are disrupting a professional culture that relies entirely on relational trust and psychological safety to even function.
So, okay, we have the theory, but how do we actually prove it? Because tracking an invisible internal psychological distortion inside a principal's head and then connecting it to a teacher crying in their car on a Tuesday afternoon, that sounds nearly impossible to measure.
It is incredibly difficult, but they found a way.
Right, because the researcher didn't just ask people for their anecdotal opinions. Here's where it gets really interesting. They mapped it out mathematically.
They did. To move this from just philosophy to hard data, the study surveyed 476 public primary and secondary school teachers in urban districts.
That's a solid sample size.
It is. And to analyze that data, they use a statistical technique called structural equation modeling, or SEM for short.
Which is a bit of a mouthful, honestly. But essentially, SEM is a way to measure the invisible, right? Like tracking a virus.
That's a great way to think of it.
Yeah, where the virus is the principal's hubris, the symptoms are the toxic leadership behaviors, and the long COVID, I guess, is the teacher burnout. Because you can't just put a dipstick into someone's brain and measure hubris.
Exactly. SEM is incredibly useful for this kind of complex behavioral research because it allows scientists to test theoretical relationships among what we call latent constructs.
Latent constructs.
Yeah, those are the underlying phenomenons like hubris or burnout that you can't measure with a single simple survey question. Like you can't just ask, are you full of hubris on a scale of 1 to 10?
Right, no one is going to check yes on that.
Exactly. So CSAM simultaneously looks at the measurement of these broad concepts and the structural relationships between them. And it actively accounts for measurement error along the way. It basically gives us a mathematical map of cause and effect.
Okay, so if hubris syndrome is the underlying invisible condition in the leader's mind, the outward symptoms must be the toxic behaviors. What does this toxicity actually look like in the data? Are we talking about principals throwing staplers, or is it more systemic?
It is usually much more systemic than throwing things. The paper operationalizes toxic leadership through four distinct observable behaviors. First, there's authoritarian control.
So my way or the highway.
Right. It's the absolute centralization of power, a complete refusal to delegate, and shutting down any collaborative decision making. Second is humiliation.
Which is awful.
It is. And this isn't always screaming. It can be actively belittling subordinates in staff meetings or dismissing their professional expertise in front of their peers.
Let me guess the third one, because I feel like I've lived through this. Is it unpredictability?
You know it well. Yes, unpredictability is a massive factor.
So it's the worst.
It really is. It keeps the staff constantly on edge, never knowing what mood the leader will be in, what the priorities are today versus yesterday, or how a totally standard request will be received.
And the fourth.
The fourth behavior is self-centered decision making. That's where choices are clearly made to benefit the leader's own image, their legacy, or their career advancement, rather than the well-being of the school or the students.
I want to focus on unpredictability for a second, because I think that is such a quiet killer in the workplace.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, you can survive a strict boss. You can even survive a really demanding boss if the rules are consistent. But a boss where the rules change depending on what they had for breakfast, that keeps your body in a constant state of fight or flight that literally fries your nervous system.
It creates an enormous cognitive load for the employee. And that brings us perfectly to the final variable in the equation, which is the burnout.
The long COVID of the situation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To measure the damage to the teachers, the study utilized the Maslach burnout inventory. Without getting bogged down in the chemical definitions, it essentially tracks three things. First, how a professional becomes emotionally depleted.
Just totally drained at the end of the day.
Right. Second, how they develop a cynical detachment from their work as a defense mechanism. They call this depersonalization. And third, how they ultimately lose their sense of personal accomplishment.
It's just devastating. You take someone who entered a profession specifically to help kids, and through prolonged exposure to a toxic environment, they become emotionally empty and feel like their work has zero value.
It's a tragedy, honestly.
Okay, so the dominoes are all set up. Hubris at the top, toxic leadership in the middle, burnout at the bottom. We have the data from the 476 teachers. What actually happened when they ran the numbers through the structural equation modeling?
The statistical results were incredibly stark. The data showed extremely strong positive correlations across the board. Hubris syndrome strongly predicted toxic leadership behaviors. And toxic leadership, in turn, heavily predicted teacher burnout.
So it wasn't just a vague trend. The math showed a heavy, direct pipeline.
Very direct.
The more a principal exhibited those hubristic traits, the detachment from reality, the excessive confidence, the more they engaged in authoritarian control, and the more their teachers experienced that profound burnout.
Yes. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, the researcher introduces what I think is the most vital and, frankly, the most fascinating finding of the entire paper.
Oh, lay it on me.
The data revealed something called partial mediation. They found that toxic leadership mediates the relationship between hubris and burnout.
Let's make sure we really understand mediation here, because this feels like the crux of the whole study.
Think of mediation as the necessary bridge between a cause and an effect. Hubris is an internal state, right? It exists solely inside the leader's mind.
Right.
For that internal delusion to actually cause harm to the staff, it requires a behavioral vehicle. Those toxic leadership behaviors, the authoritarianism, the unpredictability, the self-serving choices, those are the vehicle that delivers the harm. The internal arrogance translates into external toxicity, which then accelerates the burnout.
Wait, I want to push back on this gently. You said the math showed partial mediation.
That it did.
If it's partial, that means the overt toxic behaviors, the humiliation, the erratic rule changes, they don't account for 100% of the burnout.
You're exactly right.
The data is saying there is still a direct, measurable link from the principal's internal hubris straight to the teacher's burnout, entirely bypassing the obvious toxic behavior. How is that possible? How can a principal burn out a teacher without actually doing overtly toxic things to them?
That is the most nuanced and perhaps the most insidious finding in the entire study. The direct link between hubris and burnout remains statistically significant, even when you completely factor out the overt toxic behaviors.
That's crazy.
It means that a hubristic leader doesn't necessarily have to scream at you or belittle you or actively humiliate you to break you down.
So if they aren't yelling or being overtly mean, what are they doing that's causing the burnout?
They are creating a subtle, diffuse, ambient climate of psychological insecurity.
Ambient insecurity. That sounds exhausting.
It is. When a leader truly believes they are infallible and detached from the reality of the ground floor, they naturally create an environment filled with erratic priorities and fundamentally unrealistic expectations.
Even if they're nice about it.
Even if they're perfectly polite, they are constantly disregarding the professional expertise of their team. They mandate massive new initiatives without consulting the staff, or they ignore logistical realities because they genuinely believe their top-down visionary perspective is just superior.
Oh, I see. It is the sheer grinding exhaustion of trying to do a difficult job under someone who refuses to live in reality.
Yes, exactly.
Even if they never raise their voice, the environment itself is depleting. You are spending half your day walking on eggshells around their fragile ego. You are trying to meet goals that make no logical sense in the real world.
And you can't push back.
Right. You are being evaluated by someone who has a polite but firm contempt for your perspective. That alone, day after day, will cause profound emotional exhaustion.
You've captured the exact feeling. The hubris creates an atmosphere of chronic, low-grade stress. Employees are stripped of their professional autonomy and forced to navigate and manage the leader's delusions of grandeur.
That's a full-time job in itself.
It is. And the study highlights that while preventing overt toxic behaviors is absolutely essential, it won't solve the problem if the underlying hubristic tendencies remain unaddressed. If the leader still believes they are above it all, the work environment will remain fundamentally depleting, no matter how politely they speak.
So what does this all mean for us? We've diagnosed the disease. We understand the transmission vector, both the overt toxicity and the ambient delusion, and we see the devastating long-term effects.
The burnout.
Right. But we can't just abolish workplace hierarchy. We need principles. Mm-hmm. We need managers. If power inevitably changes human cognition, if the longer you sit in the big chair, the more detached from reality you naturally become, how do we protect teachers? And really, how do we protect any of us in the workforce from being crushed by this?
Well, the author of the study lays out three very practical structural implications based on this data. Because as you said, we can't get rid of leadership entirely.
Right.
The first solution requires a fundamental shift in selection. Hierarchical organizations need to change how they hire and promote people into these positions of power.
Because usually we just promote the person who was the best at the technical day-to-day job, right? Like the best, most effective teacher gets promoted to principal. The highest performing salesperson becomes the regional sales manager.
And that is a critical mistake if you ignore the psychological factors of leadership. The paper suggests we must stop hiring solely for technical skills or past instructional expertise. We need to start explicitly screening candidates for their power orientation, their baseline humility, and their capacity for self-regulation.
How do you even do that?
We should be using structured interviews and scenario-based assessments to identify early, subtle signs of hubristic tendencies before handing someone the keys to the organization.
That makes total sense. If hubris is essentially an allergic reaction to power, you want to test for the allergy before you give them the job.
Exactly.
So if we fix how we hire moving forward, what about the people who are already in the big chair? You can't just fire every manager and start over.
That brings us to the second pillar, development. Our entire approach to leadership training programs needs to evolve. Currently, the corporate and educational worlds tend to view bad leadership as a moral failing.
Right. Like if you're a bad boss, you must just be a bad person.
Exactly. But this research says we need to completely reframe it. Training should explicitly address the cognitive and psychological risks associated with holding power.
Oh, I like that. I'm thinking of it like getting carpal tunnel syndrome from typing too much.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah. Like, we don't view carpal tunnel as a moral failing. We view it as a structural consequence of the job. You tell leaders, hey, being in charge is going to naturally try to erode your empathy over time. It is going to try to detach you from reality. It is an occupational hazard of the chair you are sitting in.
Yes.
So you give them the tools. Here are the mental stretches and exercises you need to do to prevent it.
That perfectly captures the paper's recommendation. Leaders need continuous training that fosters deep self-awareness and openness to critical feedback and structured reflection. It requires ongoing monitoring and support. We have to treat empathy maintenance as a core job requirement, not just a one-time HR seminar on being a nice person.
Okay, so we have better selection at the front door and ongoing development for those inside. What is the third safeguard? Because relying entirely on a leader to, you know, police their own ego still feels a bit risky to me.
It is risky. Which is why the third and perhaps most critical element for immediate protection is organizational safeguards. We have to design actual systems that check unchecked authority. This study emphasizes the urgent need to build distributed leadership structures.
So power simply cannot be entirely centralized in one person's office.
Correct.
You have to force collaboration structurally, like making transparent decision-making processes mandatory, meaning the leader can't just act on their latest whim without formally justifying it to a committee or the group.
Exactly. And most importantly, organizations must establish secure, meaningful, and systematized channels for upward feedback.
Upward feedback. So the staff evaluating the boss.
Right. Subordinates must have a safe way to evaluate their leaders without any fear of retaliation. When leaders are forced to operate in environments characterized by true accountability and collective voice, it acts as a heavy anchor. It physically prevents them from floating off into that hubristic detachment from reality.
Because feedback is the absolute antidote to hubris. If hubris grows in the darkness of isolation and unquestioned authority, upward feedback is the sunlight that kills it.
Perfectly stated. And the paper warns that if we only try to treat the symptoms, like if we just offer burnt-out teachers stress management seminars or yoga classes or resilience training, it was completely futile if the toxic leadership practices remain unchallenged.
Right. You can't yoga your way out of a toxic boss.
You really can't. You cannot meditate your way out of a toxic hierarchy. You have to address the structural leadership behavior directly, or the burnout will just continue to replicate.
We have covered some massive ground today. We took a deep dive into the true mathematical nature of bad bosses, and we learned a genuinely paradigm-shifting lesson. Toxic leaders aren't always born. Very often, they are manufactured by the very systems they run.
It's a sobering thought.
It really is. The isolation of power can slowly mutate a normal, well-meaning manager, turning internal arrogance into an external observable toxicity. And that toxicity, whether it's overt unpredictability or just a quiet ambient detachment from reality, is what actively burns out the people doing the critical work on the ground.
It's an incredibly sobering look at the mechanics of authority.
Absolutely.
And this raises an important question for anyone listening today who is navigating their own career path, particularly those who are moving up the ladder and taking on management roles or leadership positions for the first time.
It does, because, you know, it is so easy to point the finger at the bad boss and assume we would never do that. But the uncomfortable truth of this research is that power changes everyone. It changes human cognition. It is an occupational hazard. So I want to leave you with this final thought to mull over today.
I love this.
If this study proves that long-term power without oversight psychologically changes a leader's empathy and their grasp on reality, what specific structural safeguards are you going to put in place for yourself when you finally get that big promotion? Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.